the European Roundtable for Industry. And my guest today is Hilde Merete Aasheim.
I started off in a local bakery. And while I was doing that, I learned a lot about sort of how to get people engaged. And I think that taught me a lot about how to be a leader. If I can be a role model, I'm happy to be a role model. But I think that my way has been that I have been exposed to a new experience, new learning through going through the ranks in a way. I can go into a higher position because I have the experience full in the rucksack.
Hello, and welcome back to the latest episode of 21st Century Industrialists, a series of interviews with some of Europe's most successful business leaders. I'm Robert O'Mara from ERT, the European Roundtable for Industry, and for this episode of our podcast, my guest is Hilde Merete Aasheim, the president and CEO of Norsk Hydro, one of the largest aluminium companies in the world. Originally from Larvik, Norway, she studied business economics at the Norwegian School of Economics, then business administration in Bergen. She initially worked in a variety of roles at Arthur Andersen & Co. and then Elkem from 1986, before moving to the executive ranks at Norsk Hydro in 2005. After working in a variety of roles there, she became president and CEO in May 2019. Since then, she has pursued a wave of change at the company, including moving away from the roller coaster of commodities and shifting more into the world of low carbon production and batteries. In 2015, she became the chairperson of the Federation of Norwegian Industries. Fortune magazine has also listed her as one of the most powerful women in business. Hilde, welcome to 21st Century Industrialists.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for making the time, because I realize that it's a very busy time, particularly in your industry. I believe you're already familiar with the format of this podcast, so let's dig into your early life. You grew up in Larvik in Norway. What kind of upbringing was it?
Well, it was a good upbringing in the sense that Larvik is 2 hours south of Oslo. It's a small city. I grew up with my father and mother. My father was a schoolmaster and a local politician. And my mother was a housewife. And I had one elderly sister, one elderly brother, and a twin sister.
Oh, a twin sister. Identical or non-identical?
No, non-identical.
And were your parents very demanding of you and your siblings?
But the focus for them was that we should develop based on the talents that we had. So they were very much focused on that they treated us not as one, but as two individuals. Mm-hmm. I liked very much to go to school. I liked to read. My sister was not so interested. and they realized that. So they sort of had focus on different topics for us, but so that she should still feel that she had a talent in other mm-hmm. areas than what I had.
So playing to everyone's strengths.
Yeah, and that we had our own sort of self-esteem in a way.
Can you share any sort of landmark moments of your childhood that sort of influenced you?
No, I think I never thought about, let's say, being a leader as I am now. We always had good debates at the breakfast table on a Sunday because then we had time. And so I really liked to understand the politics, the society, the societal development, but then really business. I started off in a local bakery. And I started on the floor to make these cakes that was going to be sold in the morning.
Very good.
But then after a while, the CEO of the bakery, he saw that I had perhaps some leadership skills because he promoted me then to sit at the order office. So to call all these shops and note what they would like to have. And so in a way, I went through the ranks in that bakery.
In your first job? My God.
No, every summer I got sort of a new task. I was at the order office, I was at the salary office, I was at the accounting. And while I was doing that, I also admired the CEO because he was not a typical CEO. His background was a baker. So he went around in that bakery in white trousers and a white t-shirt and sort of was involved in making the breads and making the cakes. He started very early in the morning.
Sure.
And then when he had done his task, he came and sat down with us working on the shop floor. Mm-hmm. He made it interesting for me to come to work.
Wow.
And I learned a lot about sort of how to get people engaged. I mean, we started there 6 o'clock in the morning and we could be tired, we could have a lot to do, but he was focusing on us. And I think that taught me a lot about how to be a leader in the sense of engaging. Today we talk about diversity, inclusive and belonging, that you actually, every person in the organization counts.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have interest in people. So that was an experience for me. And while I was working in this summer, I think I was working there for 7 summers.
As a teenager?
As a teenager. And then I went to Bergen to take my master.
Mm-hmm.
And also in these summers, I was working in the bakery. I think it triggered my business interest. I'm quite a structured person. I like orders. I like that the numbers sort out. So I was more on the sort of the financial accounting, understanding risks, not so much about the sort of the business in itself. So there I was 29 years old and had to be 50 in a way, in how I had to deal with quite massive restructuring in order to save the company.
So after university you went to Arthur Andersen?
Mm-hmm.
And you were presumably in consulting there for?
In auditing.
Auditing,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
How long did you stay there?
I stayed there for 4 years. And within these 4 years, I was sort of allocated 2 client groups.
Mm-hmm.
One was process industry, especially metal business. And the other was construction. And that was sort of that was when I really got the fascination for the metal business, because there I was auditing big process plants in Norway, which mm-hmm. was actually Elkem. So there I went to the local communities close to the waterfalls, using the natural resource, turning that into something that the world needed. And I was fascinated by, first of all, the technologies that were actually able to turn these massive raw materials using the electricity to produce something that was for use to the steel industry, to the silicone industry, and also the local communities, the shared destiny in a way that local community had. When the business went good, then the local community were thriving.
Was this business, sorry, just to clarify, was this about generating hydroelectric power?
It was using hydroelectric power to produce ferrosilicon, ferromanganese, silicon metal.
Okay.
For the global market. And then after having audited that industry, I was asked to join Elkem.
And you stayed at Elkem for
20 years.
20 years. Mm-hmm. So talk me through the different roles you had there.
Well, I was there in the corporate financial accounting for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was asked to join one of the business areas to be the financial director. When that announcement went out, it was almost 2 minutes quiet in the whole company because it was the first female director that was announced.
In what I can imagine was a pretty male-dominated industry as well.
It was, yes. And I enjoyed very much being even closer to the business. It was a global ferrosilicon business. But I also spent a lot of time out in the plants to understand the local organization, to understand the drivers behind the numbers. And then one day I was called to the CEO office of Elkem.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time I was pregnant in my 8th month, and my husband and I were going to have a baby boy.
Okay.
And I was called up for a cup of coffee to the CEO of Elkem. And he asked me to join the corporate management board of Elkem to be the HR director.
Oh, wow.
And that was my comment too.
Well, you were like, well.
Why do you need a financial person to go into the HR function? And then he said that, and actually I think it was quite foresighted, because he said that I want to business orient the HR function. I see that for Elkem to succeed, we need to have a much stronger HR agenda in order to build capability, in order to foster new leaders. And that was a surprise to me. And I had just to say that, well, I have another delivery to make.
Sure.
So you have to wait till the baby boy is delivered. And then at the hospital, it came in a big bouquet of yellow roses with a card saying, do you take the job?
Oh, my God.
So there I was taking that position.
Presumably after a couple of months.
After 3 months.
Okay.
And that was actually in a very challenging time for the company. It was around 1990. Mm-hmm. And where there was a lot of change in the markets, the Berlin, the changes in the East and West in Europe.
Of course, yeah.
And Elkem was suddenly, just after a few months that I was HR director, on the edge of bankruptcy.
Oh.
So there I was 29 years old and had to be 50 in a way, in how I had to deal with quite massive restructuring in order to save the company.
Did Elkem have a lot of interest on either side of the Berlin Wall?
No, but the market was flooded with metals.
Okay.
So it's changed the sort of the whole market situation. And we didn't have a cost position that could stand through that storm. But I learned a lot. I think it's when you deal with crisis, you really grow. And I'm proud to say that we worked hard and we managed to save the company. And also establish a culture that still is alive in Elkem. And because we had to go really deep into understanding what was the drivers to be competitive in that industry. And it was about being cost consciousness. It was about continuous improvement. It was about introducing a business system so that we could work in a structured, systematic way. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot during this. I was HR director for 8 years.
Okay.
Then I was asked to take a position as next in command for the aluminium business because Elkem had aluminium business and it was a joint venture with Alcoa. At that time, Alcoa was the most admired company in the world. So I found that very interesting to work within the aluminium business. In that period, I was also asked to be the plant manager for one of the aluminium smelters.
That's a lot of hats, if I may say.
Yeah, and the thing is that and I think often about that, that in my career, I have not applied for a job. I have been asked to take on new positions, and I've taken them. And that I use when I talk to especially female candidates, that if you have a boss which knows you and which see your talents, and sometimes you don't see it yourself. I had never applied for the HR position at that time. I had not applied for the plant manager job, but the fact that my boss said that this job you can do, Hilde, that gave me the sort of the comfort in a way that, well, if he sees that I have these capabilities, and I also know that since he tell me that, he will also support me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I have been growing over the years. And that has sort of given me the rucksack to take on a new challenge. I'm much more now focused to really follow females that has started their career in Hydro so that we are much more active in rotating them, giving them a broader experience. I have experienced that myself, that we females perhaps need that little kick.
You made the leap from Elkem to Norsk Hydro in 2005. Was that like a phone call from the rival?
Yeah. At that time, I went from aluminium to head up the silicon metal business as an executive vice president. So that was my move from staffs to line positions and to sort of run a global silicon metal business was very interesting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got this call from the CEO of Hydro asking me to be part of the corporate management board to take on the position as head of leadership and culture.
Well, it sounds like quite a broad role, executive vice president for leadership and culture. What exactly did it entail in real terms?
Well, it composed the staff positions of HR, HSE, and corporate social responsibility.
Okay, yeah, so very broad.
And at that time, Hydro was an oil and gas company and an aluminium company. But after a year in that position, we as corporate management board, together with the board of Hydro, we discussed what to do with our oil and gas business. Because at that time, we were head-to-head competing with Statoil in the Barents Sea. Mm-hmm. And eventually, the two boards in Statoil and Hydro decided to merge the oil and gas business of Hydro with Statoil.
Okay.
And then I was asked to take the lead in terms of the integration planning for this new giant of an oil and gas company. So there I was heading to Stavanger to lead the integration planning, but then also preparing to take lead in these staff positions when the company was shaped on the 1st of October in 2007.
Okay. And I mean, how long did you stay with that project?
Well, the integration planning took 1 year. There I was in the corporate management board of Statoil, what we called Statoil Hydro at that time. I had never worked in the oil and gas business.
Mm-hmm.
So when there was another call from the CEO of Hydro asking me to come back to Hydro.
We're putting the band back together.
And then I became the executive vice president for aluminium metal.
Okay, before we get into that, I do want to ask a couple more questions about that first role at Norsk Hydro.
Mm.
I guess with that, the Nordic, this very strong perception that the Nordic countries are far ahead in terms of gender equality and diversity and inclusion. What was the state of play in 2005 when you started there? Was it already quite advanced or was it just beginning?
I think it was advanced in the sense that in Norway, especially the females on the board was already at that point advanced, with 40% females in the board of a corporation. But in terms of females in leadership positions, I would say that there was a lot of females in staff positions,
mm-hmm.
but there was very few in the line positions.
Okay. Very few line managers or senior execs.
Yeah.
In the services industries, I'm guessing it's maybe easier to find at that particular time a broader talent pool. Mm. But in something like oil and gas or something like aluminium, you know, how was the recruitment process for something like that? Did you have to embark on some kind of cultural awareness or sort of campaign about the appeal of the industry for women to work
in? And that is still something we struggle with. I mean, in Hydro today, we have 22% females.
Okay.
And we have 18% female leaders. And our target is 25% female leaders and 35% in the top executives. So we still are struggling to get our industry attractive for females, particularly in the line positions.
And what kind of steps can you take to nurture that further?
I try to use my own experience in that sense, in that I'm much more now focused to really follow females that has started their career in Hydro, particularly females that are plant managers, for example, or commercial managers, and really follow them in the sense of doing what I have experienced, that people have come to me and asked me to take the next position, so that we are much more active in rotating them, giving them a broader experience. Because I think that, and I have experienced that myself, that we females perhaps need that little kick.
So more mentorship.
More mentorship, more offering. Could this be something for you? Could this be something for you? Because otherwise, it's a tendency that people stays where they are comfortable.
Do you think that there are enough women studying science, for example, or studying engineering to feed your industry and industries like it?
I think when we only look at Norway, I mean, there are a female participation in the science university of 44%. And also from my old school in Bergen, it's 42% females. But where do they go? They don't end up in our industry. And that is something I, as the CEO of Hydro today, really need to focus on. And if I can be a role model, I'm happy to be a role model. But I think that my way has been that I have been exposed to new experience, new learning through going through the ranks in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, have given me the comfort that I can take the next step. I can go into a higher position because I have the experience full in the rucksack.
I like the rucksack metaphor.
Yeah.
What do you think the EU can do to move the needle more on this?
I'm not sure that EU is what makes us going. I think we as leaders, we have to demonstrate that it's a good business case to have a diverse organization, that we work with the candidates we have, that we are attractive. And that goes also for men, actually, to give more flexibility, to see how we can deal with the work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
How we can reduce stress, how we can, I think we learned a lot during COVID, how to work. I think we have to look for ways to work that can attract and retain the best talents. And then the diversity, inclusive and belonging, which we work on, it's about gender, it's about young and experienced, to make that good blend and that everybody can blend in. Situation where I took on, I had to create a momentum. And that was so important to me, to set a very clear agenda that things had to improve. And I think based on what I had delivered up to that, I felt an enormous collective sentiment that we want to embark on this together. We will support you.
So, well, when you took on the role of CEO, just tell me about that day when you learned that you were going to be CEO of Norsk Hydro. What was the moment and how did it feel?
Well, I mean, you are part of a process, but it was, I think the most overwhelming was the day, not necessarily the day that I was announced, but more the day that my predecessor, Svein-Richard Brandtzæg, he sent me a text message at midnight where he said that now I leave my time as CEO and now you take over and I wish you all the best. And then I felt sort of an overwhelming feeling that, now I'm responsible for this company.
And that was on the day that he was stopping and the day you were, and the
that,
next day you
that
were
was
starting.
That was the day that I started.
Okay.
But I could tell you a story about the day I was announced.
Please do.
Because there was obviously a lot of traction in the media, especially in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to bed that night, I noted that, well, the commentary was that this was a solid choice. She had all the experience. She has gone through the ranks. So I was actually quite pleased with the comments from investors and from all over, and I got a lot of text messages. But then 5 o'clock in the morning, I got a call. And normally people don't call me at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then the person in the phone said, "Hilde, we are under severe cyber attack. You have to come to work."
On your first day?
On the day that I was announced. And so there I was at the head office at 5:30. There was no computers, nothing was working. And it took 9 months to come back to full operation.
Wow.
And that morning we were running the plants manual. We even brought in the people that had retired that was actually capable of operating the plant. We have 960 degrees in the pots. And so I was so afraid of the safety, the fact that something could go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any orders because the orders, everything was back. But the ones that had printed the orders in their desk, that was the heroes of the day.
Oh my God! So, like, was that something that just affected your Norwegian operations, or was it
the whole company?
Wow. Mm. Okay.
140 sites, 31,000 people.
All right. That's got to have been a stressful day and a stressful few months. We know that there's an awful lot of cyber attacks, particularly towards big corporates.
Mm.
And I can only imagine that internally it must absorb an awful lot of energy, managerial energy and team energy.
Yeah, and it was to set a sort of a crisis staff, and it was about structuring it. It was about who is doing what, who deals with the media, who deals with how to recover. And we learned a lesson, and obviously we have worked a lot on cyber response defense after, with all the barriers that need to be in place. And we have been quite open about our learnings.
I mean, when you took on that role of CEO, I recall an announcement that said you vowed to focus on improving operations. Mm. I mean, presumably that stemmed a bit from this experience with the cyber attack. So that was your sort of immediate message to investors and others. In the intervening years, we've had COVID-19, we have the war in Ukraine now. There's a lot of disruption has occurred since May 2019. Do you think you are being successful in improving operations against that tide of events and disruption?
So in the situation where I took on, I had to create a momentum. And that was so important to me, to set a very clear agenda that things had to improve. So I was clear on the 4 to 5, let's say, agenda items, which was about profitability, but then also driving sustainability. Mm-hmm. And the good thing was that I came from inside. I had been 10 years executive vice president for Aluminium Metal. I knew the company from inside. And I think based on what I had delivered up to that was that I felt an enormous collective let's say, sentiment that we want to embark on this together. We will support you. Mm-hmm. And that was a very good feeling when I was out there with my 4 or 5 points list, sort of getting the whole company, let's say, oriented on one direction, one agenda. And it was very much about working on what we could influence ourselves. And that has been, in a way, my leadership all the time, that you need to have the oversight. You need to be out there all the time to look for how is the market development? How is the mega trends? How is the, and you have to set the agenda according to that. And then you have to focus on what can we influence to position ourselves in that business environment.
You've pursued a shift more towards renewable energy production with heavy investments in the value chain for batteries. You have also sought to sort some of the commodities interests. I mean, those sound like big changes. Have COVID-19 and the wider implications of the war in Ukraine hampered progress in those new areas?
Well, what we did in 2020 was that we really made a thorough study of, let's say, the mega trends. And that was also when the green shift was announced. And we look at where does Hydro have capabilities in order to match these mega trends, which is about decarbonization, it's about electrification, and it's about circular economy. And then we saw that we had capabilities that where we could be part of that development, be part of the solution in many ways. Mm-hmm. And then we defined two strategic pillars of our strategy. It was to continue to grow and strengthen our position in low-carbon aluminium.
Yeah.
And the green shift is driving the demand for aluminium in the building and construction sector, in the aluminium, in the transport sector.
Because it's light.
Because it's light, and that is also is recyclable. I mean, aluminium is fantastic material. Yeah. Because it can be recycled and recycled without losing its properties. Mm. So the first pillar was, we believe in aluminium. We believe that aluminium is the metal for the future based on the assumption that it's also produced with a low carbon footprint. And then the second pillar was the fact that Hydro has been producing and consuming renewable energy in 116 years. Renewable energy has been the sort of the red thread of Hydro. Back to 1905.
What is that renewable energy based on? Is that hydroelectric power?
It's hydroelectric power. Mm-hmm. But then now we have defined that for the green shift to happen, the energy shift needs to happen.
Sure.
So Our second pillar of the strategy is to take an active developer role in developing more renewable power, which is solar power and it's wind power, wind onshore and wind offshore.
Is there a digital innovation dimension to the efficiencies in your business? You know, I think people have the perception that heavy industry, there's not a whole lot that can be done with digital, but talk me
and
through
it. And I don't like the word heavy industry because it sounds that you have to have sort of the raw muscles and that you have to be this macho guy that can work in this heavy, lot of smog, all these things. It's not. It's really high tech.
Okay.
And we are among the best in the world to produce primary aluminium from the electrolysis. And in order to optimize the productivity and the energy consumption, today use much more of the data that we used to use. In the past, you went out, took a test, you took a test of the metal and you analyzed it and you got some data points.
Mm-hmm.
Now we put the light on in the furnace and we extract all these data points so that you can almost, it's like an autonomous car, if you think about that. The pot itself is running within the process parameters that it's operating in a stable way.
That sounds incredible.
So yes, we use digital, but we use digital where we really see that we have an effect. It is fascinating now to see that when the crisis are at the unprecedented level now, things are starting to happen because the only solution to the energy crisis is to get more renewable energy into the equation.
We're now heading into a difficult winter. Just recently, ERT issued a paper highlighting how the energy crisis is causing the suspension or shutdown of industrial facilities in Europe.
Mm.
From what I gather, Hydro's Norwegian plants produce just over 1 million tons of aluminium annually. It's an energy-intensive business, as you were saying yourself. And you recently announced a production decrease of, I think, 10%.
Mm.
How much of that is actually driven by the energy crisis?
Well, for the Norwegian smelters, we have long-term power contracts well into 2030.
Okay.
So we are not stressed about the energy crisis for the Norwegian smelters. But the reason why we are curtailing is that with extreme unprecedented energy prices, which puts rise to the inflation, which puts rise to the interest rates, we see now that the demand for aluminium is going down.
Do you think that the deindustrialization of Europe, which is what we're hearing and seeing in some headlines, how serious do you think it is in the current context? Do you think it's a real threat?
It is serious. We've seen that the aluminium industry has curtailed 50% of the production in Europe due to the high energy costs.
Is that just Hydro or
no,
beyond?
No, that's not Hydro.
That's not Hydro. Okay.
That's the European aluminium industry.
Oh.
And the reason for that is that many of them did not have a long-term contract as we have. So because Hydro's position has all the time been to have long-term contracts, when we invest heavily in these plants, we have to have a longer horizon. But we have seen now that the aluminium industry in Europe had to close down due to the extreme high energy costs. And the threat is that if the energy shift is not happening in the sense that more renewable energy is coming into Europe, then there is a risk that these plants are not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating now to see that when the crisis are at the unprecedented level now, things are starting to happen in Germany, in France, which is in a way good to see because the only solution to the energy crisis is to get more renewable energy into the equation.
Do you think that we'll be in a much better place 3 to 5 years from now? Or is it going to take longer?
It depends very much about speed. I mean, we see how the unprecedented energy price is weighing on people's economy. So I think affordable energy is so important enabler for the just transition and for the growth of industry like ours.
Do you, with your children or with young people who approach you, what do you say to them to attract them to work in industry and get the kind of career that you've got? Because in today's world, maybe it's not the sexiest of sectors to go into. I'm just wondering, you know,
it is very sexy. Well,
sell it to me. Sell it to the listeners then.
What I see is that when we recruit these days, people don't come to Hydro to just have a job. I mean, Hydro is and was one of the top company in Norway. So just to work for Hydro back then was then you sort of were safe.
Okay. Yeah, but a job for life.
Yeah, a job for life. And we have many people in Hydro that has worked all years. But now I see that young people, they are searching for a purpose. They're searching for a company that share their values. Mm-hmm. And we have a purpose to create viable societies by turning natural resources into products and solutions that the world need. We have a tagline saying that we are in industries that matters. And when we talk about aluminium as a way of enabling the green shift, mm-hmm. and also to provide renewable energy solutions to enable the green shift, we see a much more traction on that kind of a value proposition than what we had in the past. And I think also that the sustainability agenda that we have in terms of not only working on the climate and the environment, but that we also have an ambition to improve the life and livelihood in the communities where we operate, that we are a global citizen that we can demonstrate that we are a good neighbor, that we are a positive force in the local communities, that also gets attraction from young people. Take the job. Take the opportunity. Don't hesitate. It's not that high risk. Because if you have the ones that ask you to do it, you have that support.
So what does it mean to you to be a member of ERT?
Well, first of all, it's a fantastic group of experienced CEOs. And it's a vast resource of experience. And we have seen it from time to time when we saw it in COVID, we shared experience and to hear from the different businesses, not necessarily within my business, but it gives you comfort in many areas that you are on the right track. It gives you a lot of new ideas, but also that we can join forces and be a strong voice, stronger than what you can do by yourself.
Well, on this podcast, we're always looking for new, surprising sources of leadership wisdom. Do you have a particular film or a particular book that has been a well of inspiration for you?
A role model that I had over the years was our first female prime minister in Norway, which with the name of Gro Harlem Brundtland. And in 1987, Gro Harlem Brundtland headed a UN commission, which was about gathering the international attention on our common future. I read that report just after I had joined Elkem back in 1987. And that was the first time the word sustainability was discussed. And it was talking about this just transition, actually, back then, which we talk about now in 2022, mm-hmm. In terms of we can simply not just take out from the planet. We have to replenish, and we have to also take into account the balancing of the climate actions that we have to take, but also the societal aspects. And that I've been back to that book or report many times in terms of how I have staged the sustainability agenda in Hydro.
Do you have a regular exercise routine to stay energized?
Yes.
Can you share any of the details with us?
Now, in Oslo, I live close to the forest.
Okay.
So at least twice a week, or hopefully three times a week, I go out in the forest when I get home. I used to be a handball player. Now, you know, the years gone by, I rather do the exercise by going in the forest in the spring and in the summer and the autumn, and I go cross country skiing when I have the chance to do that, also from my doorstep in Oslo or from my cabin up in the mountain. And that frees up my head in a way that I go there, I can make a presentation in my head, I can make a speech. But it's a fantastic way of exercising, but also to sort out the topics that has been on my mind during the day, but also think about the next day.
That does sound like a nice way to disconnect, actually. Final question. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Take the job. Take the opportunity. When you have people like I have told about my own career, that people has come to me and believed in me. And I said that to other females, don't hesitate. It's not that high risk because if you have that, the ones that ask you to do it, you have that support.
Yeah.
And to take on a new position, you learn a lot, you fill up the rucksack with more experience, and then the next step is not so big. And that has been my career over the years, that I've been involved and exposed to so many different positions and things that, for me, the step up to the CEO was not that big after all.
So when opportunity knocks,
yes,
open the door,
yeah,
and walk through it.
Mm.
Hilde, thank you very much for coming on 21st Century Industrialists. We wish you continued success at Norsk Hydro.
Thank you for having me.
This was this month's episode of 21st Century Industrialists, brought to you by ERT. The interview you've been listening to was edited for brevity. I was your host, Robert O'Mara. You can find out more about who else worked on this episode by checking the show notes. For more information on ERT, check out our website at ert.eu. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and tell your friends. We'll be back with another episode next month. Thank you for listening.